Welcome, everyone. Welcome back to the Strong Gravity Seminar Series. We are really fortunate to have Elisa Maggio with us today from La Sapienza University in Rome. She's, as you just mentioned, last year PhD student with Paolo Pani. So yeah, we're glad to have you, and we're looking forward to your talk. So please take it from here.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation. And yeah, it's really nice to discuss with you about these topics. So yeah, we'll talk about the ring down of dark compact objects, and then we will see what it is about. So up to date, we have detected 15 gravitational waves from the coalescence of compact binaries. And these gravitational wave signals are characterized by three main stages. So we have an in-spiral stage, when the two bodies orbit around each other, and the emission of gravitational waves makes the orbit to shrink. And then we have a merger phase, when the two bodies coalesce, and then a ring-down stage, where the final remnant relaxates to an equilibrium solution. And in this talk, we are particularly interested in the ring down stage because we want to understand what is the nature of the remnants of mergers. So the ring down stage is dominated by the characteristic frequencies of the remnant. These are called quasi-normal modes, and they are complex frequencies. They describe how the compact object responds to perturbations. And the signal emitted can be modeled as a sum of exponentially damped sinusoids. The frequencies of the sinusoids are proportional to the real part of the quasi-normal modes of the remnant, whereas the damping times of the sinusoids are proportional to the inverse of the imaginary part of the quasi-normal modes of the remnant. So from the detection of the ring down, we can infer the quasi-normal modes of the remnant and understand the nature of the compact remnant. So far, we have detected one quasi-normal mode frequency, particularly the least damped one, in the ring down of two events, GW15-0914, which was the first gravitational wave event, and the last release one, GW19-0521. So here in this plot, this is a plot of the quasi-normal mode frequency and of the quasi-normal mode the decay time estimated for the first event. And we see that these posterior curves depend on the starting time of the ring down. In particular, when the two bodies coalesce, there is an initial phase which is dominated by nonlinear effects. And then the ring down can be modeled as exponentially damped sinusoids. And this delay time here for this event is of 3 milliseconds. So after this starting time, all the posteriors for the quasi-normal mode are compatible and agree with each other. The black line here is the quasi-normal mode frequency estimated from numerical waveform, from in-spiral merger and ring down part of the signal. And this event was a remnant black hole which was spinning with a spin of about 0.7 and a mass of about 60 solar masses. And the plot for the event GW19-0521 is analogous. Also here, there are several curves with several starting times of the ring down, but here they are compared with three different numerical waveforms. And here the remnant is an intermediate mass black hole of about 150 solar masses. So both the detections are compatible with Kerr black holes, as predicted by general relativity. However, the characterization of the remnant is still an open problem. Indeed, Kerr black holes are uniquely determined by two parameters, which are their mass and their angular momentum. So from a detection of one complex quasi-normal mode frequency, we can infer only the properties of the Kerr black hole. But if we want to perform a test of the no-hair theorem, we need to detect more than one quasi-normal mode frequency in the ring down. And we will be able to do it when there will be louder gravitational wave events, but also when the detector sensitivity will improve. In particular, LISA, with its large signal-to-noise ratio in the ring down, will allow to perform unprecedented tests of the black hole paradigm. So in this talk, I will try to answer to these three questions. The first one is, are there alternative models to black holes? And then what is the gravitational wave signal that they would emit? And is this signal detectable? So the talk is split in three parts. And if you have questions at the end of each part, we can discuss about it. So concerning alternatives to black holes, there is a zoo of alternative models to black holes. And all of these models share the common feature of not having an event horizon. Then there are some models which come from quantum theories of gravity, and in order to overcome the paradoxes associated to black holes. Indeed, these solutions do not have a curvature singularity, where Einstein's theory breaks down, and neither the event horizon. So they are regular models, both in the interior and in the exterior space-time. And also they can solve some semi-classical issues associated to black holes, like their thermodynamical instability, the Hawking information loss paradox, and the fact that black holes have an entropy which is far in excess the entropy of a typical stellar progenitor. And then there are other models which are conceived within general relativity, but in the presence of beyond standard model fields, which might be dark matter fields or exotic fields. And this is the case, for example, for boson stars or Broca stars, and so on. All of these models are called black hole mimickers because they can mimic black holes in terms of electromagnetic observations. And also, as I mentioned before, they are not excluded by current gravitational wave observations. In particular, the last released gravitational wave detections with masses in the mass gap might be explained by alternative models. And there are also recent works which consider variable alternative models to black holes for the last release event. So in this talk, I will not focus on a specific model, but I will consider these solutions as a tool which allow us to quantify the existence of horizons and to quantify the black holeness of a source. So in particular, we will focus on models which deviate from the black hole solution for two parameters. One is the compactness, and the other one is the darkness. And for this reason, we will call them dark compact objects. So concerning the compactness, these solutions do not have an event horizon, so they have a radius which is a bit larger than the would-be event horizon. And this bit is parameterized by epsilon. So here in this plot, we can see that when epsilon is equal to zero, we would have a black hole with an event horizon. Whereas we can have alternative models which have a radius at a microscopical, even Planckian distance with respect to the would-be event horizon. And these solutions are called ultra-compact objects, and most of these models come from quantum theories of gravity, according to which some quantum fluctuations might prevent the formation of the event horizon. And in this model, for example, we mentioned the Gravastar model, which is a dark energy star with a Schwarzschild exterior, or wormholes, which are two copies of the Schwarzschild solution with a thin shell of exotic matter, or fuzzballs, which come from string theories. And then we can have also less compact solutions whose radius is comparable with the photon sphere of black holes. And the photon sphere is the radius of the unstable circular orbits of photons. And here we mention non-local stars, for example, which come from non-local theories of gravity, and the non-locality of the interaction makes the singularity to smear out. And we can have also neutron stars diffuse fastballs. Then another parameter which makes these models different from black holes is the darkness, which is related to the reflective properties of the object. So we can express the reflectivity of these models through a generically complex and frequency-dependent reflective coefficient. In this scenario, the black hole would have a zero reflective coefficient, because it absorbs everything that comes in. Then we can have perfectly reflecting solutions, which are totally the opposite with respect to the black hole case. And then we can have also partially absorbing solutions, where part of the incoming radiation is absorbed through viscosity or dissipation. So here I show, just as an example, a table with all the models of alternatives to black holes that have been developed. And for almost all of these models, we don't know the formation mechanisms. So we don't know dynamically how this model form. There are no available simulations about the collapse and the formation for these solutions. All of these solutions, however, are regular. They don't have any singularity. They are able to solve the semi-classical paradoxes associated to black holes. And some of these solutions, they have exotic matter, which violates energy conditions, but could be also an explanation of dark energy in our universe. So I don't know if you already have some questions about dark compact objects. Or I can continue.
I just had a comment that exotic is good, not bad. Why do you hate exotic things?
I say it could be good or not good. Yeah, I mean, you need exotic for sure, because if you conceive these objects within general relativity, you need to have exotic matter. Mm-hmm. And so you cannot avoid that.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So now we can see how the gravitational wave signal is modified if the remnant of a coalescence is a dark compact object. So in order to derive the ring down emitted by these objects, we first need to derive the quasi-normal mode frequencies. And we will see that the quasi-normal mode frequencies are completely different for these objects with respect to the black hole case. In order to derive the quasi-normal mode frequencies, we consider a gravitational perturbation, and this is governed by a second order differential equation, and it is subjected to an effective potential. Here I'm showing the effective potential in the black hole case and in the case of a dark compact object. So in the black hole case, we see that there is a peak at the photon sphere, as I said, the unstable orbit of photons. And then every perturbation goes inside the event horizon of the black hole. Whereas in the case of a dark compact object, we still have a photon sphere, but we have a cavity between the radius of the object and the photon sphere. So the absence of the event horizon implies the existence of this cavity. And inside this cavity, there are trapped modes, which will imply a completely different quasi-normal mode spectrum. So in order to derive them, we need to add two boundary conditions. And in this way, we have an eigenvalue problem, which allow us to derive the our eigenvalues, which are the quasi-normal mode frequencies. So at infinity, we impose purely outgoing waves. And in the case of a black hole, we would impose purely ingoing waves at the horizon. Whereas now we need to find another boundary condition which describes our dark compact object. So first we will analyze ultra-compact solutions. They are easier to analyze because at the radius of the ultra-compact object, we can write the solution of the equation as a superposition of ingoing and outgoing waves. So we can easily define a reflectivity a surface reflectivity coefficient as the ratio of the incoming and the reflected radiation. So we have set up the problem and we can numerically integrate the system in order to derive the quasi-normal modes. So here I show the quasi-normal mode spectrum for ultra-compact objects. And so I show the imaginary part of the quasi-normal modes as function of the real part. And the black dot is the fundamental L equal to 2 quasi-normal mode of a Schwarzschild black hole. Whereas the blue and the red lines are the quasi-normal modes of a perfectly reflecting ultra-compact object. And we see, first of all, we see that axial and polar modes are not isospectral anymore as in the black hole case. And this is a clear signature of new physics beyond general relativity. And the most important thing is that these are curves because here we are varying the radius of the ultra-compact object. And going to the left of the plot, the object is becoming almost as compact as a black hole. And we see that in this limit, the quasi-normal modes deviate dramatically from the black hole quasi-normal mode. And this is because in this case, we are analyzing a perfectly reflecting object, which is the opposite with respect to a totally absorbing black hole. And practically, these frequencies become very low. And we see indeed that both the real and the imaginary part of the frequency are very low. And they are due to the trapped modes in the cavity. Indeed, if we compute the damping times associated to these quasi-normal modes as the inverse of the imaginary part of the quasi-normal modes, we see that the damping time is very long compared to the damping time associated to the black hole quasi-normal mode. Indeed, these modes are long-lived in the cavity, so they are low frequencies, and they are responsible for this different spectrum. Now, if we look at the ring down in time domain, we see some interesting features. The first one is that the prompt ring down is the same for black holes and dark compact objects, which are ultra-compact ones, because the prompt ring down is due to the excitation of the photosphere, which is the same for both the objects. But then, in the case of a dark compact object, we have a train of subsequent echoes, which is a new signature beyond the black hole picture. Practically, these are due to the trapped modes, which leak out through the potential barrier for tunneling effects, and they generate this train of echoes. Now, the distance in time between the echoes depends on the compactness of the object through the parameter epsilon, whereas the amplitude of the echoes depends on the reflectivity coefficient of the object. So if we have a partially absorbing object, the amplitude is smaller with respect to a perfectly reflecting case. So practically, what happens is that the prompt ring down is a signature for the photosphere, whereas then the properties of the object appear at late times through this chain of echoes. And if we want to perform searches for echoes in gravitational wave data, we need accurate template for these echoes. And there has been a recent interesting work by Mark et al, according to which we can write the signal emitted by a dark compact object at infinity as the signal emitted by a black hole reprocessed by a transfer function, which depends on the parameters of the dark compact object. So in this way, we have we can construct a template which depends on the standard black hole ring down parameters plus two extra parameters related to the dark compact object. So the template will depend on the mass and the spin of the remnant, the amplitude and the phases of the plus and cross polarization, and the starting time of the ring down. And recently we constructed an analytical template, which is good in the low frequency regime, because here we expect to see these extra modes that appear for dark compact objects. So here I'm showing the absolute value and the imaginary part of the template in frequency domain. And we see these peaks, these are the resonances due to the excitation of the low frequency quasi-normal modes. And we see that the analytical template agrees pretty well with the results of a numerical integration. So now we can look at the template in time domain. And we can look at the ring down and echo waveforms. So here we are analyzing a dark compact object with a fixed compactness. And we are looking at the non-spinning case and spinning cases for several values of the reflectivity, the surface reflectivity coefficient. So for simplicity here, we choose constant values. And we choose also a complex value. So we start with a ring down, which is purely plus polarized in blue. And what we see is that when the object is spinning, the echo signal acquires also a cross polarization. So there is a mixing of the polarizations. And this happens also when the reflectivity coefficient is complex. Another interesting.
Can I ask you a question? Sure. Is the time delay the same for the two polarizations or the echo time?
Yeah, because that depends only on the compactness of the object. It seems not in this plot just because the frequency is different, the frequency content.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks.
Can I quickly ask another question? So what decides the reflectivity to be complex or not? So how can I tell whether I have a complex or not complex reflectivity?
Yeah, that depends on the model. So this is a generic framework which describes several models. And so the simplest models, like for example, a wormhole would have reflectivity equal to one, okay? Because it would reflect everything. And that would be either in phase or with inverted phase if you're considering axial or polar perturbations for that model. But there is also a model developed by Nia Yesh where the reflectivity coefficient is frequency dependent. So that depends on the model you analyze.
I see. So you're just looking at this agnostically, essentially. I see. Thanks.
Yeah. And here we see that practically, what we are seeing is that the phenomenology of echoes is very wide, depending to all these parameters. So if we want to perform searches, we need to take into account of all of these variety of situations. And for example, if we look at different phases for the reflectivity, we see that the wave, the echoes, can be always in phase, or they can be inverted in phase every time, or depending to the phase of the reflectivity, it can happen, for example, in this case, that the cross polarization disappears every three echoes. So this is also some interesting feature that we should take into account. And also, this depends on the amplitude of the reflectivity, because as I mentioned before, when the object is partially absorbing, the amplitude of the echoes is smaller than the perfectly reflecting case.
Do you mind if I ask another question?
Sure.
So I'm taking the view that Daniel was proposing that, you know, you should have a framework that's very agnostic about the underlying model. And I think that's desirable, but I think if you're going to do that, the assumption that the reflectivity coefficient should be frequency independent, should be a constant, seems very limiting. I mean, I can think that, you know, if you try to attempt, you know, a model for the interior, that would bring out all sorts of additional frequencies on top of the black hole frequencies. And you're basically not accounting for any of this. So that would, for me, limit the, you know, the phenomenology, you know, a lot.
Yeah, the point is that the framework does not put any constraint on the reflectivity. So here, these are plots where I pick a value for the reflectivity, but I could, within the template, I can put a frequency dependence on the reflectivity. So the template is generic, and you can consider also frequency-dependent reflectivity. Now here in this plot, I'm showing the echoes for constant values, but you can easily do them also with another model, which is more precise, yes.
Okay, thank you.
So may I have a question?
Yeah, sure.
In the top of panels, you put the perfect reflectivity, so now if you assume the spinning black holes, in that case there should be a ego region instabilities, that the amplitude should be amplified.
Exactly.
But it looks like the amplitude is getting suppressed for first, second, and third echoes. So
I didn't mention about the ergo region instability. The ergo region instability occurs for perfectly reflecting solutions, for example, and the time scale of the instability is much longer than the time scale of the echoes. So you would be able to see the prompt ring down, the echoes, and at very late time, you see the growing due to the ergo region instability. So that happens at very long time scales, which are not shown here.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome. And all of these templates are available in the website of our group. And so if you're interested, you can look at them, and you can also choose other values for the reflectivity coefficients, which are more motivated. So now we'll move to the analysis of less compact solutions, because I mentioned that the solutions are more complicated to analyze because we cannot express the solution of the perturbation as a superposition of waves. And so in order to describe these objects and find a proper boundary condition for these objects, we generalize the black hole membrane paradigm. And this was originally developed by Damour, Thorne, and others. And according to the paradigm, a static observer outside a perturbed black hole can replace the interior of the black hole in terms of a perturbed fictitious membrane located at the horizon of the black hole. So from the Israel junction conditions, you can map the interior of the black hole in terms of the properties of this fictitious fluid. It turns out that the fluid is viscous, and it has a bulk and a shear viscosity, zeta and eta. So what we did was to generalize this paradigm to any dark compact object. In this way, we can describe several solutions with different interiors in terms of the properties of a fictitious membrane. And yeah, again, when we perturb these less compact solutions, we analyze gravitational perturbations, and we develop this framework only for static objects, so where the exterior is Schwarzschild. And again, at infinity, we impose purely outgoing waves, and we derive these boundary conditions from the Israel junction conditions, which are valid at the radius of the less compact solution. Practically, axial and polar perturbations depend only on the parameters of the fictitious membrane, which are the shear viscosity eta and the bulk viscosity zeta. And particularly, we recover also the black hole limit. When eta is equal to 1 over 16 pi, we recover a purely ingoing wave, both for axial and for polar perturbations. So this generalized framework recovers the black hole membrane paradigm in the black hole limit. And here I show you the quasi-normal modes that we can now compute for less compact solutions. I show the real part of the quasi-normal modes and the imaginary part as function of epsilon.
Can we go back to the previous slide for a second? So so you have this viscosity, and then it's related to the boundary condition. Is that right?
Yeah, please.
So is your viscosity frequency dependent now?
So generically, the viscosity is complex and frequency dependent. Mm-hmm. And for every model, it would be different. So if you want to analyze a gravastar, it would have a specific value, mm-hmm. or a wormhole or other models. You can map the properties of these models in this parameter, which are,
complex and
frequency dependent.
Okay. And you have two viscosities, one for axial and one for polar. So what happens that if eta goes to, if eta becomes 1 over 16, so in general, should they be the same eta or there are different etas?
No, they are the same, yeah. Eta is the shear viscosity and zeta is the bulk viscosity.
Uh-huh. And in the limit that you approach a black hole,
For the axial, the potential goes to zero, so the second term disappears. Eta goes to 1 over 16 pi, and we recover a purely ingoing wave boundary condition for axial modes. For polar perturbations, instead, this term, I didn't write it because it's very long, this term vanishes, and the dependence on zeta also vanishes. Mm-hmm. And if eta is 1 over 16 pi, we again recover a purely ingoing boundary condition.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. So here I am analyzing an object which has the same. I want to say that the shear and the bulk viscosities are related to the reflective properties of the object. And here I'm analyzing an object which has the same reflective properties of a black hole. So in the limit of the ultra-compact solutions, when epsilon is very small, of course, we recover the black hole quasi-normal mode. But then when the object becomes less compact, the quasi-normal mode starts deviating from the black hole one. And again, we see that axial and polar modes are not isospectral. So they form a doublet. And these red bands are the measurement accuracies associated to the quasi-normal modes measured in the first gravitational wave event, GW15-0914. It is about 10% for the real part of the frequency and 15% for the imaginary part of the frequency. And practically, that measurement is compatible with alternative scenarios as soon as the epsilon parameter is smaller than 0.1. More or less. And now I show you how the ring down signal is modified in time domain. So in this case, we see that the prompt ring down is modified. And this happens because the prompt ring down due to the excitation of the photosphere interferes with the force echo. and there can be also a constructive pattern or a destructive one. This happens because the decay time of the prompt ringdown is comparable with the time scale associated to the first echo, and so they interfere with each other. Also, if we fit the late time part of the prompt ringdown, this perfectly gives the quasi-normal mode frequencies that I show you in the previous plot. So practically, this is dominated by the modified quasi-normal mode of the object. And also, we don't see subsequent echoes because the cavity is so small that it does not trap efficiently echoes. And we don't see this peculiar feature, which was interesting for ultra-compact solutions. And here I show you, this is a bit more technical, but I think it's very interesting. I show you the imaginary part of the quasi-normal modes as function of the real part of the quasi-normal modes, where I'm also changing the reflectivity of the object. Here, for simplicity, I'm still picking constant values of the reflectivity in this plot. And the black dot is the quasi-normal mode of a black hole, so of an ultra-compact solution which has the same reflective properties of a black hole. And then we can vary the reflective properties of the object. We can also look at less compact solutions, which are represented by all of these curves. And what we see is that when the radius of the object tends to the photon sphere, there is a universal axial quasi-normal mode. So the curves, they reduce to a dot, which does not depend anymore on the internal structure of the object itself. So for every value of, actually we proved this, for every value of the shear viscosity, which is complex and also frequency dependent, we find a universal axial quasi-normal mode. However, we do not recover the same for polar modes. So this peculiar feature does not happen for polar perturbations. And there is an interesting caveat, which happens for gravastars. So I can explain you from the boundary condition why this happens. Because when the radius of the object tends to the photon sphere, we have a divergency in the boundary condition. However, for a gravastar, the shear viscosity is such that it cancel out the divergence with this term, and we have a different boundary condition for axial modes.
Sorry, okay. Are your gravastars at 3m radius?
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't realize that. I thought gravastars could be like the size of the Schwarzschild. Radio.
Yeah, usually they are ultra compact, yes.
Yes, the surface of the gravastar should be null surface, yeah. So it should be exactly to the M. Yeah.
But this is 3M, so somehow it's a different. So yours at 3M, not 2M, right?
But this holds, let me think. So for independently on the, no, yeah. So the independently on the radius of the gravastar, the eta coefficient cancels out this term. So, yeah.
Independent of, I mean, how do they cancel? But do you assume a special eta for gravastar? That, I mean, I don't understand how they cancel.
You derive it. So eta, you derive it. Because if you know how the wave function behaves at the radius of the gravastar from these boundary conditions, you can derive eta.
Okay.
And yeah, but yeah, I agree that gravastars usually are ultra-compact solutions.
Yeah, I don't, I mean, since gravastars are ultra-compact, I don't quite see what's special about 3M, about gravastars. I mean, because all of them, all ultra-compact things have the same R equal to 3M.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, this was just an exception that we found, which is not even physically motivated, okay. as you say. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but for all the other solutions which can be less compact, they can be neutron stars, they can be non-local stars or other models, mm-hmm. We find this universal quasi-normal mode. Mm-hmm. If the radius is at the photon sphere. So practically, you don't need the information about the interior to derive the quasi-normal mode. Mm-hmm. Are there other questions before we move to the other section? No.
Yeah, I had a question. So, I mean, within this effective fluid framework where you're considering some junction condition and then mapping that to like a stress energy tensor, like across that junction. I mean, have you considered, like, if you do want to think of that as a membrane or something like that, like you're not prescribing any equations of motion for that, right? Or even letting this boundary like oscillate or things like that. Is that correct?
Yeah, so you derive the stress energy tensor of the fictitious membrane through the Israel junction conditions, where here you would have a jump between the exterior and the interior space-time. And what you assume is that the extrinsic curvature of the interior space-time is null. This is what it is done by the original black hole membrane paradigm. So you can derive these fictitious components of a viscous fluid. And we do it also at the first order of perturbation, because at the zeroth order, you would find the pressure and the characteristics of this fluid, whereas you also perturb the space-time at the first order in the perturbation. And there, you can determine the boundary condition.
So at some point, do you not need to like specify how that effective fluid would like behave under perturbations, like basically what its equation of motion would be, or is that like a higher order in perturbation theory?
So what do you mean by equation of motion? So this is valid in general. You could apply it to analyze the motion, but here we apply it for our purposes. You can derive pressure, velocity.
Yeah, I just meant imagine you have this effective fluid in the membrane or whatever, and then you take your exotic compact object and you perturb it, then like at some order in perturbation theory, you're going to like need some specification of how this like membrane sort of behaves, like what its equation of motion is under perturbations.
Mm-hmm.
So are you prescribing that, or that's like a higher order effect, or I'm just curious.
Well, because every property of the fluid is constrained from the Israel junction condition. So I do not put any extra property on the fluid.
So can I continue the questioning?
Yeah, sure.
So I can see that the membrane paradigm would give you, you know, a description of the gravitational degrees of freedom through the fluid description. So that I think I can see, but if you're doing quasi-normal modes of neutron stars, for example, and you take a neutron star that's, you know, larger than 2M but smaller than 3M, there's all the matter degrees of freedom that I don't think you're capturing in that, in that effective description.
So if you have, what this does not capture is matter in the exterior. For example, it would not describe a boson star because we are assuming that the exterior is Schwarzschild.
No, I'm fine with that. I still think you're not capturing the matter in the interior.
No, I think that yes.
Why?
So the space-time components of the interior would be set to zero. And these the matter term would appear in the stress energy tense, would still be on the right hand side.
I can clarify this because I think this is kind of the analogous thing happens when you do fluid mechanics. There are also some microscopic degrees of freedom, but when you do a viscous expansion, you ignore them, which basically tells you that you're ignoring something. And if you are in the fluid regime, it's a good expansion. You could use viscosity and possibly higher order viscosities. But fluid approximation is not always a good approximation. It's not always very predictive. So I think basically—
No, I agree with that, but I don't think that has to do with what I'm worried about.
But I think it does, because the point is that here, what Elissa is doing is writing things in terms of viscosity. But until you know what viscosity is, you cannot actually do anything with it. And in fact, there are all the higher order viscosity, there are infinite hierarchy of viscous terms. So if you don't know what they are, then you don't have a predictive theory. And that's where these higher order degrees of the other degrees of freedom that you're worrying about live. They're all these higher order viscous terms. That if somehow you could truncate this and ignore those higher order viscous terms, then you do have you don't have to worry about these extra degrees of freedom. But if there are all these other degrees of freedom and they all matter, then that means that you're not really in a fluid regime, basically, right? A perfect fluid regime. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'm not sure. Because
this is also similar to like ADS-CFT, right? That when they do, when there's a fluid approximation there, and where it doesn't work. I think there's a similarity there, the fluid gravity correspondence in ADS-CFT. So I don't think it's if you have all these other degrees of freedom that you have to worry about, then that basically means that the fluid approximation or the viscous fluid approximation just doesn't work. And so the fluid is just not a predictive framework.
I think that you can map these degrees of freedom in the shear and bulk viscosities of the fluid, which are complex and frequency dependent. So mm-hmm. they are not just two numbers, but if they are complex and frequency dependent,
more
degrees.
I think that the linear order, that's probably true. Yeah, if you have your arbitrary frequency dependence, then presumably you can get all degrees of freedom. But there are also higher order viscous terms that one can worry about. And I think they could also become important.
Mm-hmm. Let me make sure this. So now you're working on the membrane paradigm, and this is just comes from the analogy between the fluid and gravity, and you don't discuss any real viscosity or bulk viscosity, and it just comes from the analogy. And since now we have to assume the vacuum state, since we are just assume the isolated black holes. Is this correct?
So it is vacuum in the exterior, yes.
Yeah.
But the interior, it can be everything. There can be matter, because you can start from, for every model, you would have an Israel junction condition for your model, which describes, which connects, you can connect the exterior with the interior solution through the Israel junction condition. And then you can remove the information about the interior and construct the fictitious membrane.
That's the reason why I'm saying the vacuum state. So in the membrane paradigm, we assume that there is no interior inside the black hole horizon in the original argument, and whatever exists inside some region. In this paradigm, we should assume that there's no interior. So that's why,
this is a construction. It is fictitious. It's not in reality that there is anything inside. There is, but you map the problem as there is not So this is why this membrane is fictitious. It's just a mapping. But in reality, you would have some structure in the interior.
Okay.
You're welcome. Okay, so I guess I can move to the third part, which is about the detectability of dark compact objects. So a tentative evidence for gravitational wave echoes has been claimed and reported also by people here. And this evidence has been claimed by performing mesh fit searches, but also unmodeled searches, so from independent searches. And later on, some independent searches argued that the statistical significance of echoes is low and consistent with noise. And also here, there have been several works which were based on modeled searches, but also unmodeled searches. And here I've written some interesting reviews about all the zoo of dark compact objects and about the searches that has been performed for these gravitational wave echoes. And what we know is that we can put constraints on the reflectivity of dark compact objects. Indeed, if we have a perfectly reflecting dark compact object, the energy emitted in the ring down and in the echoes would be larger than the energy emitted by the ring down itself. So from this point of view, we could be able to rule out these solutions. Also, as you mentioned before, these solutions would be unstable against the ergo region instability. So we would rule them out also based on theoretical grounds. And with current signal-to-noise ratio in the ring down for LIGO, for example, indeed, we can, at 3 sigma, constrain the reflectivity of the object to be smaller than 0.9. However, in order to look for reflectivities which are close to the black hole 1, we will need a larger signal-to-noise ratio in the ring down, and we will need LISA and third-generation detectors to constrain the reflectivity of the objects that we observe through gravitational waves close to the black hole reflectivity. Concerning the compactness, we can already put strong constraints on the compactness of these solutions. And here I'm showing how the quasi-normal modes of dark compact objects change with respect to the black hole quasi-normal mode for less compact solutions and for different values of the reflectivity of the object. Practically, this is for axial and for polar perturbations, and I'm showing how the real part of the quasi-normal mode frequency change and how the imaginary part changes. The red regions are when the quasi-normal mode of the dark compact object is much larger than the black hole one, and the blue regions are when it is much lower than the black hole one, and these are percentages. So we can see, for example, that for the imaginary part of the frequency, we can have even variations of 150%. So the quasi-normal modes can change a lot with respect to the black hole case. The dashed regions are the regions of the parameter space which will be already excluded by the measurement accuracy associated to GW15 or IN14. And what we see is that already these less compact solutions will be ruled out by current measurement accuracies. We expect that with future interferometers, we will be able also to constrain more these solutions. Particularly the black regions are the only allowed regions. And this is the region that I was showing you before in the red band, where the object has almost the same reflectivity as a black hole and it can be also less compact. However, we need next generation detectors to really constrain also the compactness. With the current measurements, we can say that the object needs to have a compactness at least 99% to the 1 of a black hole, which is already a strong constraint. And also we could look at the doublet between axial and polar perturbations. And here in this plot, we perform a Fisher matrix analysis where we derive which signal-to-noise ratio would allow to resolve the doublet between axial and polar modes. And we see that for an object which is almost as reflecting as a black hole, the signal-to-noise ratio would be very large. But in other regions of the parameter space, it is possible to actually see the doublet. However, it is easier to detect deviations from the black hole quasi-normal modes than resolving the doublet, because the two frequencies are very near with each other, and you would require a large signal-to-noise ratio to resolve the doublet. So I conclude here. I don't know. Okay, there is no question. So essentially here I've shown you how we can understand the nature of compact objects and look for new physics with gravitational waves. Dark compact objects are alternatives to black holes, which are not excluded by current gravitational wave measurements. And I've shown you how the ring down and the echo signal is modified in these scenarios. So we need to develop more accurate echo templates in order to perform searches for these new signatures. Also, we need to develop Fourier spiral merger and ring down waveforms in order to analyze how these objects are formed in a coalescence. And LISA will allow us for sure to perform a test of the black hole paradigm and confirm or rule out the existence of alternatives. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks a lot, LISA, for a really nice talk. So we had quite some discussion already during the talk, which is good. So I'm just wondering if there are any more questions for Elisa at this time.
I just have one quick question, which I've been thinking about recently. I thought maybe you know the answer to, which is if I'm looking in different polarizations, do I expect to see echoes at the same time, basically, in both polarizations? Or would be a slight difference? Because I imagine because of the spin of the black hole, the two different polarizations wouldn't exactly act the same way. So is this something you've thought about?
Because I think that they should appear at the same time, because the delay time depends on only on the compactness of the object.
But if you just look at, if you look at your plots, the one that you showed different polarization, yeah. It kind of looks like different polarizations arrive at different times, but
For sure, the packet has a different frequency components. So what I think is that this makes us seem that the time is different. But I just think that the packet has a different frequency content. I think that they appear, they start at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, because what's happening is that at least for very, the space-time of a black hole is curved, of course, right? So you don't have, point particles that are coming out. You have the wave packet. And wave packet with different polarization, because I mean, gravitational wave is polarized, would probably interact differently with the same metric. It wouldn't just come on a straight line, because it has a size and it's propagating through curved metric. So I think, I guess that's an interesting thing to look at, to see, because we do see, we do have different detectors and they do have a slightly different polarization, but I guess some of them have very different polarization. And if this is, if the signal But if there is extra information that can be gained by using different detectors, that would be interesting, right?
Yeah, I think this is an important information because if you look for echoes, by assuming that the time of arrival is the same, it is relevant.
Yeah, yeah. So that's why I'm wondering that's how big of an effect that could be. Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Niyash. Any other questions? Final thoughts, comments?
I have one question, Daniel, if you don't
sure.
mind.
Sure. Pablo, go ahead, please.
Thank you. Thank you, Elisa, for your talk. Very interesting. I was just wondering, maybe this is a more, basic motivational question, but so this alternatives are, looking to replace the concept of black hole altogether, or the point is to have them somewhat coexist. Like you could actually have some black holes, like in, our general concept of black holes, and some other alternatives that perhaps, they will have another ring down signature, or it's just like one or the other, like there only can be one.
No, they can all exist. Some of these models were originally born as alternatives to black holes, specifically the ones that come from quantum theories of gravity. But the general idea is that all of these solutions might coexist with black holes and neutron stars. And this is essentially a way to understand what is the interior of what we observe, a way of quantifying the existence of horizons, of trying to understand the interior. In principle, they can all coexist, and then with future observations, we can put constraints on these solutions.
Okay, I see. Okay.
Thanks,
so there's no, I mean, for instance, there hasn't been any work in, say, neutron star collapse onto alternative models of black holes or things like this.
Yeah, from this point of view, only boson stars have been, only the formation of boson stars have been studied in detail dynamically, but for all the other models, it is still not known.
Right. So they're more kind of like ad hoc models too. Yeah, I see.
Yeah, they are constructed theoretically, but still not dynamically.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, I see. Thank you very much, Elisa.
Thank you.
I guess one defense is, this is supposed to be from quantum gravity, and we don't really have a theory of quantum gravity, so it's going to be hard to simulate a theory that doesn't exist yet. So, sorry, yeah.
But some assumptions, like she, Elisa was showing a table with a bunch of other models, right? And mm-hmm. some of the models have funny assumptions.
They're all funny. I mean, they're all exotic, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of like hard to imagine how to match our regular understanding of, the normal matter and like how to make peace with this kind of funny assumptions in general. No?
But it's a question of, do you think, general relativity is all there is, or is the quantum mechanics also exist in the universe? If you think that quantum mechanics is also part of a universe, then you should be able to fit them in the same framework somewhere. So from that point of view, it will be funny. So general relativity should fail at some level. Now exactly where it wants to fail is kind of your pick. And you can either hide it behind the horizon or just deal with it in plain sight.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, modeling the formation of objects which come from quantum theories of gravity, for now there are not the tools to do it. Whereas boson stars, which is GR with additional fields, you can model them for now. So we need to know, of course, at these scales, how if quantum gravity occurs and how it does it, and we don't know yet.
Right. But I mean, for instance, if here you're just focusing on the ring down, right, of the like two signals measured by LIGO, but you're also thinking of, or well, I don't know, that's also interesting. Like, I don't know if you're thinking that before the merger, the two objects are black holes and then they become kind of like this alternative object, or even from the beginning, they're this alternative objects, and perhaps there's extra signatures we could also go and look for in spiral and, you know, pre-merger.
Yeah, part. also before, they can coalesce, the coalescing binaries could be not black holes. So you would see FX because if they have some form of matter, if they are deformed, there are also studies about this. I just dealt with the ring down because it's the part I analyzed, but there are works about also the in-spiral.
Okay, I see. But then you're not assuming two black holes merge onto an exotic compact
no,
object.
No, you can have exotic object merging.
Perfect.
For example, there is actually a recent very interesting work which claims that the last event might be the head-on of two Proga stars.
Right.
So they computed numerical waveforms for these scenarios where the binary is not a binary black hole.
Mm-hmm. Okay, perfect. Thank you very much, Elisa, very interesting.
And I just had another quick question. So I saw on your last slide something about LISA, and I missed that point. Can you clarify the connection to LISA?
Yeah, so LISA will have a much larger signal-to-noise ratio in the ring down compared to LIGO or Virgo. It will have a signal-to-noise ratio of 100 of 1,000 in the ring down compared to 10 that we have now. And so you can see if there are, for example, echoes or extra features in the ring down, because now there is a lot of noise in the ring down, and we are not able to detect it very well. But with LISA, we will have larger signal-to-noise ratio, and we are able to actually see something.
I see. Thank you. Good. Any final thoughts, questions? Okay. If not, then let's thank Elisa again for a nice talk. And
thank you for
see
all
the comments, back next week.
And the discussion.
Thank you, Mary.